He turned it over in his hand. Polly tossed her head. "I'm sure I don't know. The letter was on top of it, and that's every bit I can tell you." Forget to tell me, indeed, if her mother were alive. Darrell waved her away. "Please call Mr. Anthor." Anthor's viewpoint on the matter differed radically from that of Arcadia's father. He punctuated his initial remarks with clenched fists and torn hair, and from there passed on to bitterness. "Great space, what are you waiting for? What are we both waiting for? Get the spaceport on the viewer and have them contact the Unimara." "Softly, Peleus. She's my daughter." "But it's not your galaxy." "Now wait. She's an intelligent girl, Peleus, and she's thought this thing out carefully. We had better follow her thoughts while this thing is fresh. Do you know what this thing is?" "No. Why should it matter what it is?" "Because it's a sound receiver." "That thing?" "It's homemade, but it will work. I've tested it." "Don't you see? It's her way of telling us that she's been a party to our conversations of policy. She knows where Homer Munn is going and why. She's decided it would be exciting to go along." "Oh, great space," groaned the younger man. "Another mine for the second foundation to pick. Except that there's no reason why the second foundation should, a priori, suspect a 14-year-old girl of being a danger. Unless we do anything to attract attention to her, such as calling back a ship out of space for no reason other than to take her off. Do you forget with whom we're dealing? How narrow the margin is that separates us from discovery? How helpless we are thereafter? But we can't have everything depend on an insane child." "She's not insane, and we have no choice. She need not have written the letter, but she did it to keep us from going to the police after a lost child. Her letter suggests that we convert the entire matter into a friendly offer on the part of Munn to take an old friend's daughter off for a short vacation. And why not? He's been my friend for nearly 20 years. He's known her since she was 3, when I brought her back from Trantor. It's a perfectly natural thing, and in fact, ought to decrease suspicion. A spy does not carry a 14-year-old niece about with him." "So, and what will Munn do when he finds her?" Dr. Darrell heaved his eyebrows once. "I can't say, but I presume she'll handle him." But the house was somehow very lonely at night, and Dr. Darrell found that the fate of the galaxy made remarkably little difference while his daughter's mad little life was in danger. The excitement on the Unimara, if involving fewer people, was considerably more intense. In the luggage compartment, Arcadia found herself in the first place aided by experience, and in the second, hampered by the reverse. Thus, she met the initial acceleration with equanimity and the more subtle nausea that accompanied the inside-outness of the first jump through hyperspace with stoicism. Both had been experienced on space hops before, and she was tensed for them. She knew also that luggage compartments were included in the ship's ventilation system, and that they could even be bathed in wall light. This last, however, she excluded as being too unconscionably unromantic. She remained in the dark, as a conspirator should, breathing very softly and listening to the little miscellany of noises that surrounded Homer Munn. They were undistinguished noises, the kind made by a man alone. The shuffling of shoes, the rustle of fabric against metal, the soughing of an upholstered chair seat retreating under weight, the sharp click of a control unit, or the soft slap of a palm over a photoelectric cell. Yet, eventually, it was the lack of experience that caught up with Arcadia. In the book films and on the videos, the stowaway seemed to have such an infinite capacity for obscurity. Of course, there was always the danger of dislodging something which would fall with a crash, or of sneezing. In videos, you were almost sure to sneeze. It was an accepted matter. She knew all this and was careful. There was also the realization that thirst and hunger might be encountered. For this, she was prepared with ration cans out of the pantry. But yet, things remained that the films never mentioned, and it dawned upon Arcadia with a shock that, despite the best intentions in the world, she could stay hidden in the closet for only a limited time. And on a one-man sports cruiser such as the Unimara, living space consisted essentially of a single room, so that there wasn't even the risky possibility of sneaking out of the compartment while Mun was engaged elsewhere. She waited frantically for the sounds of sleep to arise. If only she knew whether he snored. At least she knew where the bunk was, and she could recognize the rolling protest of one when she heard it. There was a long breath and then a yawn. She waded through a gathering silence, punctuated by the bunk's soft protest against a changed position or a shifted leg. The door of the luggage compartment opened easily at the pressure of her finger and her craning neck. There was a definite human sound that broke off sharply. Arcadia solidified. Silence. Still silence. She tried to poke her eyes outside the door without moving her head, and failed. Head followed the eyes. Omer Mun was awake, of course, reading in bed, bathed in the soft, unspreading bedlight, staring into the darkness with wide eyes and groping one hand stealthily under the pillow. Arcadia's head moved sharply back of itself. Then the light went out entirely, and Mun's voice said with shaky sharpness, "I've got a blaster, and I'm shooting by the galaxy." And Arcadia wailed, "It's only me! Don't shoot!" Remarkable what a fragile flower romance is. A blaster with a nervous operator behind it can spoil the whole thing. The light was back on, all over the ship, and Mun was sitting up in bed. The somewhat grizzled hair on his thin chest and the sparse one-day growth on his chin lent him an entirely fallacious appearance of disreputability. Arcadia stepped out, yanking at her Medellin jacket, which was supposed to be guaranteed wrinkle-proof. After a wild moment in which he almost jumped out of bed, but remembered and instead yanked the sheet up to his shoulders, Mun gargled,
What?
He was completely incomprehensible. Arcadia said meekly, "Would you excuse me for a minute? I've got to wash my hands." She knew the geography of the vessel and slipped away quickly. When she returned, with her courage oozing back, Homer Mun was standing before her with a faded bathrobe on the outside and a brilliant fury on the inside.
"What the black holes of space are you doing aboard this ship? How did you get on here? What do you think I'm supposed to do with you? What's going on here?"
He might have asked questions indefinitely, but Arcadia interrupted sweetly. "I just wanted to come along, Uncle Homer."
"Why? I'm not going anywhere."
"You're going to Calgan for information about the Second Foundation." And Mun let out a wild howl and collapsed completely. For one horrified moment, Arcadia thought he would have hysterics or beat his head against the wall. He was still holding the blaster, and her stomach grew ice cold as she watched it.
"Watch out. Take it easy," was all she could think of to say.
But he struggled back to relative normality and threw the blaster onto the bunk with a force that should have set it off and blown a hole through the ship's hull.
"How did you get on?" he asked slowly, as though gripping each word with his teeth very carefully to prevent it from trembling before letting it out.
"It was easy. I just came into the hangar with my suitcase and said, 'Mr. Munn's baggage,' and the man in charge just waved his thumb without even looking up."
"I'll have to take you back, you know," said Homer, and there was a sudden, wild glee within him at the thought.
By space, this wasn't his fault. You can't, said Arcadia, calmly. It would attract attention. What? You know. The whole purpose of your going to Calgan was because it was natural for you to go and ask for permission to look into the mule's records. And you've got to be so natural that you're to attract no attention at all. If you go back with a girl stowaway, it might even get into the telenews reports. Where did you get those notions about Calgan? These, childish. He was far too flippant for conviction, of course, even to one who knew less than did Arcadia. I heard. She couldn't avoid pride completely. With a sound recorder. I know all about it. So you've got to let me come along. What about your father? He played a quick trump. For all he knows, you're kidnapped. Dead. I left a note, she said, over-trumping. And he probably knows he mustn't make a fuss or anything. He'll probably get a spacegram from him. To Mun, the only explanation was sorcery, because the receiving signal sounded wildly 2 seconds after she finished. She said, "That's my father, I bet." And it was. The message wasn't long, and it was addressed to Arcadia. It said, "Thank you for your lovely present, which I'm sure you put to good use. Have a good time." "You see," she said, "that's instructions." Homer grew used to her. After a while, he was glad she was there. Eventually, he wondered how he would have made it without her. She prattled. She was excited. Most of all, she was completely unconcerned. She knew the Second Foundation was the enemy, yet it didn't bother her. She knew that on Calgan he was to deal with a hostile officialdom, but she could hardly wait. Maybe it came of being 14. At any rate, the week-long trip now meant conversation rather than introspection. To be sure, it wasn't a very enlightening conversation, since it concerned almost entirely the girl's notions on the subject of how best to treat the Lord of Calgan. Amusing and nonsensical, and yet delivered with weighty deliberation. Homer found himself actually capable of smiling as he listened, and wondered out of just which gem of historical fiction she got her twisted notion of the great universe. It was the evening before the last jump. Calgan was a bright star in the scarcely twinkling emptiness of the outer reaches of the galaxy. The ship's telescope made it a sparkling blob of barely perceptible diameter. Arcadia sat cross-legged in the good chair. She was wearing a pair of slacks and a none-too-roomy shirt that belonged to Homer. Her own, more feminine wardrobe had been washed and ironed for the landing. She said, "I'm going to write historical novels, you know." She was quite happy about the trip. Uncle Homer didn't the least mind listening to her, and it made conversation so much more pleasant when you could talk to a really intelligent person who was serious about what you said. She continued, "I've read books and books about all the great men of Foundation history. You know, like Selden, Hardin, Mallow, Devers, and all the rest. I've even read most of what you've written about the mule, except that it isn't much fun to read those parts where the Foundation loses. Wouldn't you rather read a history where they skipped the silly, tragic parts?" "Yes, I would," Mun assured her gravely. "But it wouldn't be a fair history, would it, Arcady? You'd never get academic respect unless you give the whole story." "Oh, poof. Who cares about academic respect?" She found him delightful. He hadn't missed calling her Arcady for days. "My novels are going to be interesting and are going to sell and be famous. What's the use of writing books unless you sell them and become well known? I don't want just some old professors to know me. It's got to be everybody." Her eyes darkened with pleasure at the thought, and she wriggled into a more comfortable position. "In fact, as soon as I can get Father to let me, I'm going to visit Trantor, so as I can get background material on the First Empire, you know."
I was born on Trantor. Did you know that? He did, but he said, "You were," and put just the right amount of amazement into his voice. He was rewarded with something between a beam and a simper. Uh-huh. My grandmother, you know, Beta Durell, you've heard of her, was on Trantor once with my grandfather. In fact, that's where they stopped the mule when all the galaxy was at his feet. And my father and mother went there also when they were first married. I was born there. I even lived there till mother died. Only I was just 3 then, and I don't remember much about it. Were you ever on Trantor, Uncle Homer? No, can't say I was. He leaned back against the cold bulkhead and listened idly. Calgan was very close, and he felt his uneasiness flooding back. Isn't it just the most romantic world? My father says that under Stannel the Fifth, it had more people than any 10 worlds nowadays. He says it was just one big world of metals. One big city that was the capital of all the galaxy. He's shown me pictures that he took on Trantor. It's all in ruins now, but it's still stupendous. I'd just love to see it again. In fact, Homer.
Yes?
Why don't we go there when we're finished with Calgan? Some of the fright hurtled back into his face. What? Now don't start on that. This is business, not pleasure. Remember that. But it is business, she squeaked. There might be incredible amounts of information on Trantor. Don't you think so? No, I don't. He scrambled to his feet. Now untangle yourself from the computer. We've got to make the last jump, and then you turn in. One good thing about landing, anyway. He was about fed up with trying to sleep on an overcoat on the metal floor. The calculations were not difficult. The space route handbook was quite explicit on the Foundation Calgan route. There was the momentary twitch of the timeless passage through hyperspace, and the final light year dropped away. The sun of Calgan was a sun now. Large, bright, and yellow-white. Invisible behind the portholes that had automatically closed on the sunlit side. Calgan was only a night's sleep away. Chapter 12. Lord. Of all the worlds of the galaxy, Calgan undoubtedly had the most unique history. That of the planet Terminus, for instance, was that of an almost uninterrupted rise. That of Trantor, once capital of the galaxy, was that of an almost uninterrupted fall. But Calgan? Calgan first gained fame as the pleasure world of the galaxy 2 centuries before the birth of Harry Seldon. It was a pleasure world in the sense that it made an industry, and an immensely profitable one at that, out of amusement. And it was a stable industry. It was the most stable industry in the galaxy. When all the galaxy perished as a civilization, little by little, scarcely a feather's weight of catastrophe fell upon Calgan. No matter how the economy and sociology of the neighboring sectors of the galaxy changed, there was always an elite. And it is always the characteristic of an elite that it possesses leisure as the great reward of its elitehood. Calgan was at the service, therefore, successively and successfully, of the effete and perfumed dandies of the imperial court, with their sparkling and libidinous ladies, of the rough and raucous warlords who ruled in iron the worlds they had gained in blood, with their unbridled and lascivious wenches, of the plump and luxurious businessmen of the Foundation, with their lush and flagitious mistresses. It was quite undiscriminating, since they all had money. And since Calgan serviced all and barred none, since its commodity was in unfailing demand, since it had the wisdom to interfere in no world's politics, to stand on no one's legitimacy, it prospered when nothing else did, and remained fat when all grew thin. That is,
until the mule. Then, somehow, it fell too, before a conqueror who was impervious to amusement or to anything but conquest. To him, all planets were alike, even Calgan. So for a decade, Calgan found itself in the strange role of galactic metropolis, mistress of the greatest empire since the end of the galactic empire itself. And then, with the death of the mule, as sudden as the zoom, came the drop. The foundation broke away. With it, and after it, much of the rest of the mule's dominions. 50 years later, there was left only the bewildering memory of that short space of power, like an opium dream. Calgan never quite recovered. It could never return to the unconcerned pleasure world it had been, for the spell of power never quite releases its hold. It lived instead under a succession of men whom the Foundation called the Lords of Calgan, but who styled themselves First Citizens of the Galaxy, in imitation of the Mule's only title, and who maintained the fiction that they were conquerors too. The current Lord of Calgan had held that position for 5 months. He had gained it originally by virtue of his position at the head of the Calganian Navy, and through a lamentable lack of caution on the part of the previous Lord. Yet no one on Calgan was quite stupid enough to go into the question of legitimacy too long or too closely. These things happened, and are best accepted. Yet that sort of survival of the fittest, in addition to putting a premium on bloodiness and evil, occasionally allowed capability to come to the fore as well. Lord Stettin was competent enough, and not easy to manage. Not easy for His Eminence, the First Minister, who, with fine impartiality, had served the last Lord as well as the present, and who would, if he lived long enough, serve the next as honestly. Nor easy for the Lady Calia, who was Stettin's more than friend, yet less than wife. In Lord Stettin's private apartments, the three were alone that evening. The First Citizen, bulky and glistening in the Admiral's uniform that he affected, scowled from out the unupholstered chair in which he sat as stiffly as the plastic of which it was composed. His First Minister, Lev Maris, faced him with a far-off unconcern, his long, nervous fingers stroking absently and rhythmically the deep line that curved from hooked nose along gaunt and sunken cheek to the point nearly of the gray-bearded chin. The Lady Calia disposed of herself gracefully on the deeply furred covering of a fomite couch, her full lips trembling a bit in an unheeded pout. "Sir," said Maris. It was the only title adhering to a lord who was styled only First Citizen. "You lack a certain view of the continuity of history. Your own life, with its tremendous revolutions, leads you to think of the course of civilization as something equally amenable to sudden change. But it is not." The mule showed otherwise. "But who can follow in his footsteps? He was more than man, remember. And he, too, was not entirely successful." "Poochie," whimpered the Lady Calia suddenly, and then shrank into herself at the furious gesture from the First Citizen. Lord Stettin said harshly, "Do not interrupt, Calia." "Maris, I am tired of inaction. My predecessor spent his life polishing the Navy into a finely tuned instrument that has not its equal in the galaxy. And he died with the magnificent machine lying idle. Am I to continue that? I, an admiral of the Navy? How long before the machine rusts?" he went on. "At present, it is a drain on the treasury and returns nothing. Its officers long for dominion, its men for loot. All Calgan desires the return of empire and glory. Are you capable of understanding that?" "These are but words that you use," said Maris. "But I grasp your meaning. Dominion, loot, glory. Pleasant when they are obtained, but the process of obtaining them is often risky and always unpleasant. The first fine flush may not last, and in all history it has never been wise to attack the foundation. Even the mule would have been wiser to refrain. There were tears in the Lady Calia's blue, empty eyes. Of late, Poochie scarcely saw her, and now, when he had promised the evening to her, this horrible, thin, gray man, who always looked through her rather than at her, had forced his way in. And Poochie let him. She dared not say anything, was frightened even of the sob that forced its way out. But Stettin was speaking now in the voice she hated, hard and impatient. He was saying, "You're a slave to the far past. The foundation is greater in volume and population, but they are loosely knit and will fall apart at a blow. What holds them together these days is merely inertia, an inertia I am strong enough to smash. You are hypnotized by the old days when only the foundation had nuclear power. They were able to dodge the last hammer blows of the dying empire, and then faced only the unbrained anarchy of the warlords who would counter the Foundation's nuclear vessels only with hulks and relics. But the mule, my dear Maris, has changed that. He spread the knowledge that the Foundation had hoarded to itself through half the galaxy, and the monopoly in science is gone forever. We can match them." "And the second foundation?" questioned Maris coolly. "And the second foundation?" repeated Stettin as coolly. "Do you know its intentions? It took 5 years to stop the mule, if indeed it was the factor which some doubt. Are you unaware that a good many of the Foundation's psychologists and sociologists are of the opinion that the Selden plan has been completely disrupted since the days of the mule? If the plan has gone, then a vacuum exists which I may fill as well as the next man. Our knowledge of these matters is not great enough to warrant the gamble. Our knowledge, perhaps. But we have a Foundation visitor on the planet. Did you know that? A Homer Munn, who I understand has written articles on the mule and has expressed exactly that opinion, that the Selden plan no longer exists." The First Minister nodded. "I have heard of him, or at least of his writings. What does he desire?" "He asks permission to enter the mule's palace." "Indeed. It would be wise to refuse. It is never advisable to disturb the superstitions with which a planet is held." "I will consider that. And we will speak again." Maris bowed himself out. Lady Calia said tearfully, "Are you angry with me, Poochie?" Stettin turned on her savagely. "Have I not told you before never to call me by that ridiculous name in the presence of others?"
"You used to like it."
"Well, I don't anymore, and it is not to happen again." He stared at her darkly. It was a mystery to him that he tolerated her these days. She was a soft, empty-headed thing, comfortable to the touch, with a pliable affection that was a convenient facet to a hard life. Yet even that affection was becoming wearisome. She dreamed of marriage, of being first lady. Ridiculous. She was all very well when he had been an admiral only. But now, as first citizen and future conqueror, he needed more. He needed heirs who could unite his future dominions, something the mule had never had, which was why his empire did not survive his strange, non-human life. He, Stettin, needed someone of the great historic families of the Foundation with whom he could fuse dynasties. He wondered testily why he did not rid himself of Kallia now. It would be no trouble. She would whine a bit. He dismissed the thought. She had her points occasionally. Kallia was cheering up now. The influence of Greybeard was gone, and her Poochie's granite face was softening now. She lifted herself in a single, fluid motion and melted toward him.
"You're not going to scold me, are you?"
"No." He patted her absently. "Now just sit quietly for a while, will you? I want to think."
"About the man from the Foundation?"
"Yes."
"Poochie?"
This was a pause. "What?"
"Poochie, the man has a little girl with him, you said. Remember? Could I see her when she comes?"
"I never..." "Now what do you think I want him to bring his brat with him for? Is my audience room to be a grammar school? Enough of your nonsense, Kallia."
"But I'll take care of her, Poochie. You won't even have to bother with her. It's just that I hardly ever see children, and you know how I love them."
He looked at her sardonically. She never tired of this approach. She loved children, i.e. his children, i.e. his legitimate children, i.e. marriage. He laughed. "This particular little piece," he said, "is a great girl of 14 or 15. She's probably as tall as you are." Kallia looked crushed.
"Well, could I anyway? She could tell me about the Foundation. I've always wanted to go there, you know. My grandfather was a Foundation man. Won't you take me there sometime, Poochie?"
Stettin smiled at the thought. Perhaps he would, as conqueror. The good nature that the thought supplied him with made itself felt in his words. "I will. I will. And you can see the girl and talk Foundation to her all you want. But not near me, understand?"
"I won't bother you, honestly. I'll have her in my own rooms."
She was happy again. It was not very often these days that she was allowed to have her way. She put her arms about his neck, and after the slightest hesitation, she felt its tendons relax and the large head come softly down upon her shoulder. Chapter 13. Lady. Arcadia felt triumphant. How life had changed since Peleus Anthor had stuck his silly face up against her window, and all because she had the vision and courage to do what needed to be done. Here she was on Calgan. She had been to the great central theater, the largest in the galaxy, and seen in person some of the singing stars who were famous even in the distant Foundation. She had shopped all on her own along the Flowered Path, fashion center of the gayest world in space. And she had made her own selections because Homer just didn't know anything about it at all. The saleswomen raised no objections at all to long, shiny dresses with those vertical sweeps that made her look so tall. And Foundation money went a long, long way. Homer had given her a 10-credit bill, and when she changed it to Calganian Calganids, it made a terribly thick sheaf. She had even had her hair redone, sort of half-short in back, with two glistening curls over each temple. And it was treated so that it looked goldier than ever. It just shone. But this was best of all. To be sure, the palace of Lord Stettin wasn't as grand and lavish as the theaters, or as mysterious and historical as the old Palace of the Mule, of which, so far, they had only glimpsed the lonely towers in their air flight across the planet. But imagine a real lord. She was wrapped in the glory of it. And not only that, she was actually face to face with his mistress. Arcadia capitalized the word in her mind because she knew the role such women had played in history, knew their glamour and power. In fact, she had often thought of being an all-powerful and glittering creature herself. But somehow, mistresses weren't in fashion at the Foundation just then, and besides, her father probably wouldn't let her, if it came to that. Of course, the Lady Calia didn't quite come up to Arcadia's notion of the part. For one thing, she was rather plump and didn't look at all wicked and dangerous. Just sort of faded and nearsighted. Her voice was high, too, instead of throaty, and Calia said, "Would you like more tea, child?" "I'll have another cup, thank you, Your Grace." Or was it Your Highness? Arcadia continued with a connoisseur's condescension. "Those are lovely pearls you are wearing, my lady." On the whole, my lady seemed best. "Oh, do you think so?" Calia seemed vaguely pleased. She removed them and let them swing milkily to and fro. "Would you like them? You can have them if you like." "Oh, my. You really mean?" She found them in her hand, then, repelling them mournfully, she said, "Father wouldn't like it." "He wouldn't like the pearls? But they're quite nice pearls." "He wouldn't like my taking them, I mean. You're not supposed to take expensive presents from other people," he says. "You aren't? But, I mean, this was a present to me from the First Citizen. Was that wrong, do you suppose?" Arcadia reddened. "I didn't mean..." But Calia had tired of the subject. She let the pearls slide to the ground and said, "You were going to tell me about the Foundation. Please do so right now." And Arcadia was suddenly at a loss. What does one say about a world dull to tears? To her, the Foundation was a suburban town, a comfortable house, the annoying necessities of education, the uninteresting eternities of a quiet life. She said uncertainly, "It's just like you view in the book films, I suppose." "Oh, do you view book films? They give me such a headache when I try. But do you know, I always love video stories about your traders, such big, savage men. It's always so exciting. Is your friend Mr. Munn one of them? He doesn't seem nearly savage enough. Most of the traders had beards and big bass voices and were so domineering with women. Don't you think so?" Arcadia smiled glassily. "That's just part of history, my lady. I mean, when the Foundation was young, the traders were the pioneers pushing back the frontiers and bringing civilization to the rest of the galaxy. We learned all about that in school. But that time has passed. We don't have traders anymore, just corporations and things." "Really? What a shame. Then what does Mr. Munn do? I mean, if he's not a trader." "Uncle Homer's a librarian." Calia put a hand to her lips and tittered.
"You mean he takes care of book films? Oh, my. It seems like such a silly thing for a grown man to do."
"He's a very good librarian, my lady. It is an occupation that is very highly regarded at the Foundation." She put down the little iridescent teacup upon the milky, metalled table surface. Her hostess was all concern.
"But my dear child, I'm sure I didn't mean to offend you. He must be a very intelligent man. I could see it in his eyes as soon as I looked at him. They were so intelligent. And he must be brave, too, to want to see the Mule's Palace."
"Brave?" Arcadia's internal awareness twitched. This was what she was waiting for. Intrigue. Intrigue. With great indifference, she asked, staring idly at her thumb tip, "Why must one be brave to wish to see the mule's palace?"
"Didn't you know?"
Her eyes were round and her voice sank. "There's a curse on it. When he died, the mule directed that no one ever enter it until the empire of the galaxy is established. Nobody on Kalgan would dare even to enter the grounds." Arcadia absorbed that.
"But that's superstition."
"Don't say that."
Callie was distressed.
"Poochie always says that. He says it's useful to say it isn't, though, in order to maintain his hold over the people.
But I notice he's never gone in himself."
"And neither did Thalos, who was first citizen before Poochie."
A thought struck her, and she was all curiosity again.
"But why does Mr. Munn want to see the palace?"
And it was here that Arcadia's careful plan could be put into action. She knew well from the books she had read that a ruler's mistress was the real power behind the throne, that she was the very wellspring of influence. Therefore, if Uncle Homer failed with Lord Stettin, and she was sure he would, she must retrieve that failure with Lady Callia. To be sure, Lady Callia was something of a puzzle. She didn't seem at all bright.
But, well, all history proved.
She said, "There's a reason, my lady. But will you keep it in confidence?"
"Cross my heart," said Callie, making the appropriate gesture on the soft, billowing whiteness of her breast.
Arcadia's thoughts kept a sentence ahead of her words.
"Uncle Homer is a great authority on the mule, you know. He's written books and books about it, and he thinks that all of galactic history has been changed since the mule conquered the Foundation."
"Oh, my.
He thinks the Selden Plan..."
Callia clapped her hands.
"I know about the Selden Plan. The videos about the traitors were always all about the Selden Plan. It was supposed to arrange to have the Foundation win all the time. Science had something to do with it, though I could never quite see how. I always get so restless when I have to listen to explanations. But you go right ahead, my dear. It's different when you explain. You make everything seem so clear."
Arcadia continued.
"Well, don't you see, then, that when the Foundation was defeated by the mule, the Selden Plan didn't work, and it hasn't worked since? So who will form the Second Empire?"
"The Second Empire?"
"Yes. One must be formed someday, but how?"
"That's the problem, you see. And there's the Second Foundation."
"The Second Foundation?"
She was quite completely lost.
"Yes, they're the planners of history. They're following in the footsteps of Selden. They stopped the mule because he was premature, but now they may be supporting Kalgan."
"Why?"
"Because Kalgan may now offer the best chance of being the nucleus for a new empire."
Dimly, Lady Callia seemed to grasp that.
"You mean Poochie is going to make a new empire?"
"We can't tell for sure. Uncle Homer thinks so, but he'll have to see the mule's records to find out."
"It's all very complicated," said Lady Callia doubtfully.
Arcadia gave up. She had done her best. Lord Stettin was in a more or less savage humor. The session with the milksop from the Foundation had been quite unrewarding. It had been worse. It had been embarrassing. To be absolute ruler of 27 worlds, master of the galaxy's greatest military machine, owner of the universe's most vaulting ambition, and left to argue nonsense with an antiquarian. Damnation. He was to violate the customs of Kalgan, was he? to allow the mule's palace to be ransacked so that a fool could write another book? The cause of science, the sacredness of knowledge, great galaxy. Were these catchwords to be thrown in his face in all seriousness? Besides, and his flesh prickled slightly, there was the matter of the curse. He didn't believe in it. No intelligent man could. But if he was going to defy it, it would have to be for a better reason than any the fool had advanced. "What do you want?" he snapped, and Lady Calia cringed visibly in the doorway.
"Are you busy?"
"Yes, I am busy."
"But there's nobody here, Poochie. Couldn't I even speak to you for a minute?"
"Oh, Galaxy, what do you want? Now hurry." Her words stumbled.
"The little girl told me they were going into the mule's palace. I thought we could go with her. It must be gorgeous inside."
"She told you that, did she? Well, she isn't, and we aren't. Now go tend your own business. I've had about enough of you."
"But, Poochie, why not? Aren't you going to let them? The little girl said that you were going to make an empire."
"I don't care what she said." What was that? He strode to Calia and caught her firmly above the elbow so that his fingers sank deeply into the soft flesh. "What did she tell you?"
"You're hurting me. I can't remember what she said if you're going to look at me like that."
He released her, and she stood there for a moment, rubbing vainly at the red marks. She whimpered,
"The little girl made me promise not to tell."
"That's too bad. Tell me. Now."
"Well, she said the Selden plan was changed and that there was another foundation somewheres that was arranging to have you make an empire. That's all. She said Mr. Munn was a very important scientist and that the Mule's Palace would have proof of all that. That's every bit of what she said. Are you angry?"
But Stettin did not answer. He left the room hurriedly, with Callia's cow-like eyes staring mournfully after him. Two orders were sent out over the official seal of the First Citizen before the hour was up. One had the effect of sending 500 ships of the line into space on what were officially to be termed as war games. The other had the effect of throwing a single man into confusion. Homer Munn ceased his preparations to leave when that second order reached him. It was, of course, official permission to enter the palace of the mule. He read and reread it with anything but joy. But Arcadia was delighted. She knew what had happened. Or at any rate, she thought she did. Chapter 14. Anxiety. Polly placed the breakfast on the table, keeping one eye on the table news recorder, which quietly disgorged the bulletins of the day. It could be done easily enough without loss of efficiency, this one-eye-absent business. Since all items of food were sterilely packed in containers which served as discardable cooking units, her duties vis-à-vis breakfast consisted of nothing more than choosing the menu, placing the items on the table, and removing the residue thereafter. She clacked her tongue at what she saw and moaned softly in retrospect. "Oh, people are so wicked," she said, and Durrell merely hemmed in reply. Her voice took on the high-pitched rasp which she automatically assumed when about to bewail the evil of the world. "Now, why do these terrible Calganis," she accented the second syllable and gave it a long A, "do like that? You'd think they'd give a body peace, but no, it's just trouble, trouble all the time. Now look at that headline. Mobs riot before Foundation Consulate. Oh, would I like to give them a piece of my mind if I could. That's the trouble with people. They just don't remember. They just don't remember, Dr. Durrell.
got no memory at all. Look at the last war after the Miwol died. Of course, I was just a little girl then, and oh, the fuss and trouble. My own uncle was killed, him being just in his 20s and only 2 years married with a baby girl. I remember him even yet. Blonde hair he had, and a dimple in his chin. I have a trimensional cube of him somewheres. And now his baby girl has a son of her own in the Navy, and most likely if anything happens. And we had the bombardment patrols and all the old men taking turns in the stratospheric defense. I can imagine what they would have been able to do if the Kalganis had come that far. My mother used to tell us children about the food rationing, the prices and taxes. A body could hardly make ends meet. You'd think if they had sense, people would just never want to start it again, just have nothing to do with it. And I suppose it's not people that do it, either. I suppose even Kalganis would rather sit at home with their families and not go fooling around in ships and getting killed. It's that awful man Stettin. It's a wonder people like that are let live. He kills the old man. What's his name? Thallos? And now he's just spoiling to be boss of everything. And why he wants to fight us, I don't know. He's bound to lose, like they always do. Maybe it's all in the plan, but sometimes I'm sure it must be a wicked plan to have so much fighting and killing in it, though to be sure I haven't a word to say about Harry Seldon, who I'm sure knows much more about that than I do, and perhaps I'm a fool to question him. And the other Foundation is as much to blame. They could stop Kalgan now and make everything fine. They'll do it anyway in the end. And you'd think they'd do it before there's any damage done.
Dr. Durrell looked up.
Did you say something, Polly?
Polly's eyes opened wide, then narrowed angrily.
Nothing, Doctor. Nothing at all.
I haven't got a word to say. A body could as soon choke to death as say a word in this house. It's jump here and jump there, but just try to say a word. And she went off simmering. Her leaving made as little impression on Durrell as did her speaking.
Kalgan. Nonsense. A merely physical enemy. Those had always been beaten.
Yet he could not divorce himself of the current foolish crisis. 7 days earlier, the mayor had asked him to be administrator of research and development. He had promised an answer today.
Well,
he stirred uneasily. Why himself? Yet could he refuse? It would seem strange, and he dared not seem strange. After all, what did he care about Kalgan? To him, there was only one enemy. Always had been. While his wife had lived, he was only too glad to shirk the task, to hide. Those long, quiet days on Trantor, with the ruins of the past about them, the silence of a wrecked world and the forgetfulness of it all. But she had died. Less than 5 years, all told, it had been. And after that he knew that he could live only by fighting that vague and fearful enemy that deprived him of the dignity of manhood by controlling his destiny, that made life a miserable struggle against a foreordained end, that made all the universe a hateful and deadly chess game. Call it sublimation. He himself did call it that. But the fight gave meaning to his life. First to the University of Santani, where he had joined Dr. Clyes. It had been 5 years well spent. And yet Clyes was merely a gatherer of data. He could not succeed in the real task. And when Durrell had felt that as certainty, he knew it was time to leave. Clyes may have worked in secret, yet he had to have men working for him and with him. He had subjects whose brains he probed. He had a university that backed him. All these were weaknesses. Clyes could not understand that, and he, Durrell, could not explain that. They parted enemies. It was well. They had to. He had to leave in surrender. In case someone watched. Where Clies worked with charts, Durrell worked with mathematical concepts in the recesses of his mind. Clies worked with many, Durrell with none. Clies in a university, Durrell in the quiet of a suburban house. And he was almost there. A second foundationer is not human as far as his cerebrum is concerned. The cleverest physiologist, the most subtle neurochemist, might detect nothing. Yet the difference must be there. And since the difference was one of the mind, it was there that it must be detectable. Given a man like the mule, and there was no doubt that the second foundationers had the mule's powers, whether inborn or acquired, with the power of detecting and controlling human emotions, deduced from that the electronic circuit required, and deduced from that the last details of the encephalograph on which it could not help but be betrayed. And now Clies had returned into his life in the person of his ardent young pupil, Anthor. Folly. Folly. With his graphs and charts of people who had been tampered with. He had learned to detect that years ago, but of what use was it? He wanted the arm, not the tool. Yet he had to agree to join Anthor since it was the quieter course. Just as now he would become administrator of research and development. It was the quieter course. And so he remained a conspiracy within a conspiracy. The thought of Arcadia teased him for a moment, and he shuddered away from it. Left to himself, it would never have happened. Left to himself, no one would ever have been endangered but himself. Left to himself, he felt the anger rising. Against the dead Clies, the living Anthor, all the well-meaning fools. Well, she could take care of herself. She was a very mature little girl. She could take care of herself. It was a whisper in his mind. Yet could she? At the moment that Dr. Durrell told himself mournfully that she could, she was sitting in the coldly austere anteroom of the executive offices of the First Citizen of the Galaxy. For half an hour she had been sitting there, her eyes sliding slowly about the walls. There had been two armed guards at the door when she had entered with Homer Munn. They hadn't been there the other times. She was alone now, yet she sensed the unfriendliness of the very furnishings of the room, and for the first time. Now, why should that be? Homer was with Lord Stettin. Well, was that wrong? It made her furious. In similar situations in the book films and the videos, the hero foresaw the conclusion, was prepared for it when it came, and she just sat there. Anything could happen. Anything. And she just sat there. Well, back again. Think it back. Maybe something would come. For 2 weeks, Homer had nearly lived inside the mule's palace. He had taken her once, with Stettin's permission. It was large and gloomily massive, shrinking from the touch of life to lie sleeping within its ringing memories, answering the footsteps with a hollow boom or a savage clatter. She hadn't liked it. Better the great, gay highways of the capital city, the theaters and spectacles of a world essentially poorer than the Foundation, yet spending more of its wealth on display. Homer would return in the evening, awed. "It's a dream world for me," he would whisper. "If I could only chip the palace down, stone by stone, layer by layer of the aluminum sponge, if I could carry it back to Terminus, what a museum it would make." He seemed to have lost that early reluctance. He was eager instead, glowing. Arcadian knew that by the one sure sign.